This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I, at age 40, am like the youngest dad there.
Wow.
I mean, there's like dads walking around with canes and stuff. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Modern science, baby. Modern science.
So,
now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, Education Policy's own royalty, Dara Z. Handler.
Oh, I like that. I always wanted to be a princess, but I figured once you get the PhD, the royal route was out.
Is that right? Or what? You're not allowed to be... princes aren't allowed to marry PhDs? What's up with that?
No, that's not true. But Sonia Sotomayor, when she went on Sesame Street, was like, princess is not actually a job. And so if you want to have, you know, take control over your own future, have a promising career, you know, princess is fine, but maybe go for like engineer, lawyer, doctor,
yes,
something non-royal.
Right, that's
but I'll
good.
Take though, the title.
Though, hey, I think Princess Kate is going to have a big impact already. She's you know, people, I don't know, are happy for her. There's a lot of talk about the baby.
I'm not
happy
for her.
She probably has some causes. I don't know what they are, but she probably will adopt
some. I'm not happy for her.
Some.
I had a big old crush on Prince William when I was about 13. I'm not happy for her at all.
Well, he's balding anyway, so.
Yeah, now Harry is supposed to be the desirable one, probably also because he's not married.
Well, and he's the rebel, right? I mean, he's got no angle on the throne. So, I mean, he's got nothing to lose. You got to watch out for that. That's a little bit dangerous.
Warn your daughters.
You know, we need our social obligations or else we go off track. So I worry about Harry. Okay, lots to discuss here in education policy. Note that we are not going to talk about Carlos Danger. Oh,
We're talking about it now.
Okay. All right. But if he comes up, we're not going to talk about it. I know you want to, Dara, but we are not going to go there.
I don't.
Okay. Pamela, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
Late last week, the House of Representatives passed a rewrite of No Child Left Behind. Will this be the year ESEA is renewed?
Come on. Pamela, you know better. Of course not. Of course not. But look, this is more progress than we have seen since 2002. On updating this law, so it is still significant. And whenever the politics shift and allow for things to get done up on Capitol Hill, this will be an important marker.
Well, one of the things I think is interesting about the way that they're going about the renewal that is different from the last round is that this time each camp has sort of, they're not trying to come to a compromise straight off the bat, that each camp kind of went into their corners or back to their offices or whatever you want to call it and came up with their own plans.
You know,
and
corner now, sounds much more exciting than just
I know,
going back
but
to
I'm
their
trying
offices.
Not to.
So that
I'm,
is what they did. You're right. They went
I'm
to their
I'm trying
offices.
Not to imply that they're fighting. that each party went back to their proverbial corners and came up with what they thought what their main points were, rather than trying to draw out a collaborative process that might make this even more and more and more drawn out. Now, of course, you have the challenge of what you still have to meet in the middle because it has to pass. But it'd be interesting to see if this process is going to yield any different results.
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, you can imagine what happens in the Senate. So they're going to bring this to the floor. They say it is hard to imagine that they're going to get any Republican votes for the Harkins bill. In terms of actually passing, unless some Republicans decide, like Lamar Alexander, that they will vote for it just so it will go to conference committee. And then there can be a negotiation. And so to stop the filibuster, or at least to vote to not filibuster the bill and let it go forward. I think more likely is that we're going to see if the Republicans take control of the Senate, which the conventional wisdom, again, says they are likely to do, though the conventional wisdom has been wrong before. If they take control of the Senate, then you could imagine that this Republican bill will get will show some progress in 2015. And at that point, they would sit down and negotiate with President Obama, who will be holding out a veto threat. So this is how this could play out. Bottom line, not going anywhere fast. But still, I still believe that whenever this thing finally happens, it's going to be a significant rollback of No Child Left Behind. And hey, our lefty friends in the education reform community, you need to come to grips with this. And it's okay, because we're in a different place than we were before. We've got a real school reform infrastructure at the state level. We don't need to beat states over the head from the federal level with all of the bad things that come along with that, in my humble opinion, Dara. Okay, topic number two.
With the release of Park's cost estimates, we can finally compare the costs of the two consortia-developed Common Core exam packages. Park will cost $30, while Smarter Balance is offering a complete system for $27 and a basic option for $22 a pop. Oklahoma and Georgia have already withdrawn from Park, seemingly in response to the news. Is the sky falling for the testing consortia?
Okay, I think that we might be... Is the sky falling for the testing consortia might not necessarily be related to these test prices. And I think in order to determine whether cost is a determining factor for states withdrawing, we have to know, well, how much are they currently paying right now? I mean, is this a lot more expensive? Is this a little bit more expensive? The answer is we're not entirely sure. According to Pew, states pay between $0 and $44 for the physical standardized test. The number could be a little bit higher. Brookings did a report last year that it costs about $65 per student in grades 3 through 9, but that's for more than just the physical exam. Mm-hmm. It's also for all of the other associated costs that go along with standardized testing. So I think that, you know, we're looking at a sky is falling scenario, but to pin it to these test prices is might be a false comparison.
Right. Look, in Georgia, we know they're spending about $8 a test right now, so this would be a significant increase. Now, they'd get more because they'd get these annual writing tests that they don't currently have. But even in Georgia, it's, you know, is it about the cost? They could find the money. We're talking about 1/3 of 1% of their per pupil spending. Okay, they could find the money. The bottom line is the politics in Georgia, as in other places, are tough. The governor is under extraordinary heat from the right. He's got a potential primary challenger. So, you know, this was an excuse, in my view, you know, to say, look, oh, it's really about the money, and that's why we're not doing it. We're going to somehow find a way to develop our own test in Georgia that is high quality and aligned to the Common Core, but costs less. And I'd say good luck with that.
And again, I think you need to know what that number is. So in New York, they pay, New York State pays $7 a pupil for standardized testing, but it's because they pass a lot of the costs on to the district. So if Georgia says we're spending $8 a pop, well, does that mean in total, are the districts paying more? How much does the actual test cost? Mm-hmm. This is an easy number to use as an excuse. Yeah.
Look, back to the sky is falling point, though. I think this is important to say. We have been, we knew at Fordham, other supporters, we have said all along that we were never going across the finish line with 45 states using the standards and the consortia assessments. We were saying that back in 2009, 2010, because, look, it was easy for states to sign up for the standards and for the tests, and all the hard stuff was going to come later. And so it is not surprising that we're seeing states peel off. And this is the time for them to do it, because if they're going to use a different test, they have got to put out a contract for it. Now, time is short. We're now less than 2 years out from that testing window. So this is the time. At this point, it's still, you know, look, we still have about 40 states signed up for the standards and the tests. I don't think we'll end up with 40, but 40 is a big number, and it's much bigger than I think most of us would have predicted we'd be at this point in time. Topic number 3.
Lawmakers in North Carolina have approved a voucher program for special education students. Is this a good approach to special education?
This is a good question, Dara. I mean, there's 2 points here. One is, you know, I think in the school choice world, people see it as a good approach to school choice. In other words, you get the ball rolling in states where these are sometimes the easiest programs to pass, and that whets the appetite among lawmakers for broader school choice programs. And certainly we are supportive of these, particularly if they have good accountability provisions holding schools accountable for results. Now, the intricacies of how this works in the special ed world, I think there's some real pros in that it does create some better incentives. We've always worried that the current incentives say to school districts, if you identify a child as special education, we will provide a lot more funding for that child. And there's been a question about whether or not that encourages districts to ID kids as special ed who may not be special ed. This way, the incentives work a little bit differently because that money is going to follow the child to another school. What do you think, Dara?
I think that when it comes to special education, the incentive that comes with identifying more students and the extra money doesn't pay for what the district has to provide. Special education is extremely expensive. IDEA has a lot of rules about the number of staff and the services that you have to provide. Vouchers might be an opportunity for districts to actually spend their money more efficiently if students are able to take the money with them and go to a school that is better suited to their needs. Mm-hmm. And the problem, that one of the other benefits is that this could potentially avoid the long drawn out process of a special education student not being able to have their needs met in the mm-hmm. traditional district schools. Then you go through a lawsuit, then the student has to be provided with an education, and so they end up going to private school. Yep. Or the district spends a whole lot more money. Perhaps this is not necessarily an end around, but just a more efficient solution to educating students whose needs aren't being met by traditional district schools.
And you know, a lot of people are confused because they say, well, wait, I thought we already had these private placements. As you say, we know that there are some special education kids going to private schools. Now, that is only after they have been identified, there's been an IEP, and the school district admits that it does not have what it takes to serve the child within the district, then the private placement is the last resort. My understanding with these voucher programs is as long as a child has an IEP and that's, you know, that qualifies under this program, the parents can immediately decide to take them somewhere else, even if the school district says, hey, we've got what it takes to serve you within our own schools.
Right. And the traditional argument for school districts against vouchers is that it's taking public dollars and putting them in private schools. But with these special education students, that money, not only might it be already lost anyway because the district can't educate the student, but the district might not even be able to educate the student with the additional public funds that it receives by identifying them.
And this is why politically it's easier to pass these bills. Some districts are saying, hey, good riddance. We don't want to serve these kids because they cost a lot of money.
Doesn't mean they shouldn't try.
No, it's right. I mean, which is, I'm not saying that this is not
it's a general point.
I'm just saying that is the attitude among some. It's similar in the early days of charter schools. There were some charter schools that served these kind of kids who were delinquent or who had gone to fights, or, you know, these are the kinds of kids that public schools often say, hey, fine, you want to take those kids off my hand? Go for it.
But it speaks to a larger point of, should we be dividing and conquering, that all schools can't be all things right to all students? So focus on the sectors where you can do the most good.
I love it. All right. But you know what? The Education Gadfly Show can be all things to all people who care about education policy. That is all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Have you participated in this royal baby craziness this week?
Well, I mean, how could you avoid it? It's everywhere.
Do you like it? Does it make you sick?
I mean, it's okay. I mean, I found myself like watching a train wreck, the Barbara Walters special on last night about the baby, and I'm clicking, and I just stopped, and I'm nice. Like, all right, I watched just some of it. So
I saw some clip of an interview with some friend of Prince William who said he's going to get mucky, you know, in his role as being a father. So which implies he's going to change diapers. Now, think this is true? He would for sure be the first future king of England to change diapers, don't you think?
If she's doing it, he's doing it.
No, I know. And look, all this stuff. Look, right. Hey, us modern fathers, we do these things.
That's
okay.
Right.
That's true. Mike is probably the only man in this office who consistently empties the dishwasher.
Hey, all right. I like that. I was going to say, but Joe also changes diapers. Yes, right. Yes, he does. Okay, Amber, what you got for us?
Anyway, I've got Education at a Glance 2013. So this is this huge compendium of international data, 440 pages long. So I just thumbed through it. 30-plus developed countries participate in the OEC data collection. So these are developed countries. I mean, data about everything and anything. So I'm just going to highlight a few. Okay. Less than 70% of students entering post-secondary education graduate. In Japan, let's play along. This could be more fun.
Wait, less than 70%? We would be lucky to have that high of a rate.
Well, ours is, what's ours, Mike? You know all this data.
For post-secondary, I don't know, about 50% maybe?
52. Pretty good. Hungary, we're us in Hungary, 52%. Uh-huh. Japan is at the high end take a guess.
I don't know, 90%?
90%.
Boom.
Yes. On average, individuals with a college degree earns 57% more than those with only upper secondary. Makes sense. Annual spending per student in OECD nations ranges from $2,400 in Turkey to over Luxembourg spends. How much do you think Luxembourg spends? Little tiny Luxembourg.
$25,000.
$21,000. Woo! In 2010, OECD countries spent an average of 6.3% of their GDP on educational institutions. Denmark was at the high end, about 8%. Mm-hmm. Hungary at the low end, 4.5%. U.S., what do you think? Where are we?
We're like about 5%.
Yeah, yeah. This one's at 7.
Oh, 7%. It's 7. Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting. That's right, which is the... Yes, that's right. I was looking at this, at one point. Yeah. 7%, which everybody, and I, by the way, I hate that statistic though. Well, because people always say, oh, we should be spending more of our GDP on education. I just think that's kind of a silly measure to look at.
It could be.
Look at real dollars.
You're delving into my minute. Between 2009 and 10, public expenditures on ed institutions fell in one third of OECD countries, including, so public expenditures falling. Mm. Of course, here, Italy, Estonia, and Iceland joined us.
Yeah, because they had some pretty tough times. Certainly Italy and Iceland, for sure.
Between 2000 and 2011, salaries rose in almost all OECD countries and grade levels, except for France and Japan. Hmm. The salaries of teachers per primary student increased by 10%. Yet, between 2009 and 2011, as expected, they fell for the first time since 2000 by about 2% at all levels. Participation in education among 20 to 29-year-olds increased by 10 percentage points on average. Czech Republic, Iceland, Turkey, and Korea saw some of the biggest gains. All right. You'll like this one. Globally, the average age at which mothers have their first child across the world has risen from 24 in 1970 to, how old do you think, in 2009?
These are among developed countries.
Developed countries.
28.
28, that's right. Why are you so good at this? 28. On average, OECD countries have one teacher for every 14 kids in upper secondary school. Mexico has the highest. How many kids in a Mexico classroom, you think, per teacher?
24.
28. Portugal has the lowest.
Muchas grande.
8 kids in Portugal per
what?
Per teacher.
Where does that number come from? I had 34 kids in my third period.
Yeah.
All right, last factoid. Together, Australia, Canada, France, Germany, and the UK, and the US, sorry, receive more than 50% of all foreign students nationwide.
Woo. Wow, good stuff here.
I mean, 440 pages, and I had to get 10 factoids. Come on.
Interesting. I love it. Look, this thing about when people have their first baby, I find it fascinating. I was in Arkansas this week, and by the way, Arkansans, which is how you say it, very friendly. They share your southern accent. I'm sure it's a different accent than you have from Virginia, but they're very nice. But that's one of the things I'm struck with. You know, you'd meet these people that were like my age and their kids were graduating from high school. I'm like, what? Where did you get started? Right. And they're like, well, everybody gets started, you know, and has babies in their early 20s. I'm like, I go to playgrounds in D.C. where there's toddlers.
Yeah.
And I, at age 40, am like the youngest dad there.
Yeah, wow.
I mean, there's like dads walking around with canes and stuff. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Modern science, baby. Modern science.
So, all right. Well, so my point is these differences are kind of interesting.
They are interesting because they're not just here, right?
Yeah, that's happening all around the world. That's
so,
right.
You know, you think we're unique in some of these ways, but we're not.
All right. That's all the time we've got this week. Until next week.
I'm Darazi Handelar.
And I'm Mike Petrilli, The Education Gadfly Show, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.